You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Before we get to Michael Malice, ladies and gentlemen, the most important thing is I'm going to be at the Tempe Improv tonight, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Tempe Improv. If you are in anywhere near Arizona, for that matter, anywhere in the United States, get on a plane and come see me. I will make you laugh hard, real hard.
Well, and I'm Michael Malice, the pride of America, so
this is that's true. That's true.
Your website is completely cracks me up. Everybody should know that Michael Malice is his Instagram is essentially pictures of succulents.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, you're a succulent enthusiast, obviously.
Well, I actually have one of the best succulent collections in the States, and some of those plants have never been photographed before.
Right. Well, that's very, very impressive. Oh, by the way, I'm being told by my engineer, my producer, announced the show. This is the Brian Callen / Hunter Macho. Our guest is the esteemed and the great and the always colorful Michael Malice, who happens to be one of the biggest succulent enthusiasts in the United States.
I'm actually over the succulents because I got them all that I wanted. But
really?
I caught them all.
I was in China as a boy, and I went to this ancient bonsai forest where they were
many reasons why I already don't believe this story.
Because is that because bonsai is actually a Japanese? It's actually
and
not.
Also because there's a forest of them. Like
I know.
A forest of mini trees. I don't really believe this.
Well, believe it or not, I believe bonsai, the art comes from China and then was emigrated into, was brought to Japan. So in fact, I went to, I guess, the place where the master bonsai, you know, arborists reside. And as a boy, I remember wanting one of those bonsai. I love saying bonsai. People say bonsai. I say bonsai trees more than anything in the world. And they were like, some of them were 300-400 years old. So,
well,
Brian, I couldn't have one.
Just to clarify, bonsai is a Japanese art form using miniature trees grown in containers. Similar practices exist in other cultures, including the Chinese tradition of Penjing, from which the art originated.
What I was saying is I went to a Penjing forest.
Well, you know, there's a big controversy in the bonsai community with the succulent community.
Really?
Oh.
Yes, because many... Okay, here we go.
I love that Michael Malice knows this.
Many succulents naturally grow in a bonsai form. So they're not trees that are stunted. They're just miniature trees and things that mimic trees. So the question is, can these be considered bonsai or is it cheating?
Oh. That's very interesting, actually. And the art of bonsai is to take a tree and keep and grow it until it reaches maturity, but you keep pruning it in such a way that you basically create a miniature version of it.
And it has to have certain growing forms, is my understanding. There's certain like historically approved types that they have to grow in shape.
Well, whatever I saw in China was the most incredible thing. This is on the mainland of China. Mm-hmm. It was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen. Okay, so we've covered...
You say Penjing, I say bonsai.
I was going to say.
It's like,
we've covered bonsai, Penjing, and succulents.
Alpha as fuck.
Exactly. Michael, you said something interesting, and I really... it kind of resonated. I appreciated it. You were like, look, everybody uses a ghostwriter if you're an athlete, if you're a politician, whatever you are. And you should, because, oh, by the way, writing a book is no joke. It's very difficult. It's something a lot of people think they could probably do, but very few people can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just read a couple of ghostwritten books that are just absolutely dreadful, so people can do it poorly as well.
Yeah. Well, I read Open by Andre Agassi, but of course it was written by the guy who wrote The Tender Bar, and it was outstanding. And there's, it just makes complete sense. And you've done this a lot. So
Yeah. Here's
what I want to talk about. You know, Hunter and I always talk about some of the best ideas are stuck in books. I love your point of view. I loved your article in The Guardian about basically essentially I'm saying I'm not going to vote because it makes no goddamn difference. We don't live in a democracy, et cetera, et cetera.
And we can't.
And we can't. So let's talk about the big ideas. If Hunter and I wanted to write a book called The Big Ideas,
right?
What are those ideas to you?
Okay, you're coming out swinging. I told Hunter that get ready. There's going to be blood, and he said no holds barred. The big ideas.
That's how I roll.
Okay. The idea that human beings are functions of our biology, I think, is a really big idea that people have problems with. The idea that societies are run not through force but via heresy and taboo, I think, is another big one.
Oh, wait a minute. It dilate on that
I can't wait. Wait, we have to. I want to dilate on all these points, but give us all of them, and then we'll go from
there. Okay.
You know, the idea that, and this is coming back, I think, a little bit, that, you know, democracy, any kind of group decision-making, is even theoretically impossible. It's always going to have some elite determining what are the criterions for the decisions that are going to be made. And the idea that, that if you're nice, that people will flock to you. I think that one's falling out of favor, but that's another big one that I see a lot that bothers me.
Well, you know, Adam Grant, who wrote Give and Take, would disagree with you. He says givers win in this society.
Not always. I mean, that's the thing.
Well, within parameters. You've got to be, you know,
the
givers, people that are worth it.
That's givers are both the most successful and the least successful people. And also Dacher Keltner, who's at Berkeley, wrote this, does research basically on power and all of that sort of stuff. And he says that the sort of 48 laws of power, Machiavellian view of power, it does work under certain circumstances, but it doesn't work under, in a society like ours, actually, you know, some sort of altruism works better.
It's not good for innovation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd agree with that completely. My point is, I don't think giving and being nice are synonymous. I think frequently nice people are just unempowered bad people.
Ooh, that makes a lot of sense. I love your not. It's not pessimism. It feels like realism. You've really thought these thoughts out.
Politics.
Let's go back, yeah. Michael, to the idea that we are products of our biology.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think most people, like a lot of this, parent rearing books and this whole industry, the idea that somehow you can control how your children turn out, that's not a function of the data. The data determines almost, you know, the vast majority of personality is genetically determined. And you see this, you know, in case after case where parents are wringing their hands, how could this have happened? And, you know, and one brother's one way, the other brother's the other way. It's like, well, they were both raised in the same household. How do you have different results given the same input? So things like that, Steven Pinker, who we discussed briefly last time, I think he talks very heavily about how a major function of our society is the repudiation of biology.
Right. Repudiates the idea, the notion of that we're born a blank slate, which was a very Marxist sort of a way of thinking back. I mean, it was very, very, still very strong in some academic circles.
Well, I don't think it's just Marxist. I think it's much broader than that. I think the whole progressive vision is the idea of the plasticity of the human body and mind. And you know, through culture or government, we can kind of rearrange anything, i.e. let's teach men not to rape and things like that.
Right.
I think that's completely false. Again, my background is through like zoology and stuff like that. And I think if people are interested in politics, they'd be far more of use to read The Dog Whisperer than anything written by, you know, some kind of TV commentator.
I love him. But Michael, what about training? I mean, look, Dan Coyle and people who wrote The Talent Code, I mean, that training... And the right attitude and your emotional state when you come to something, you can change the way. I mean, Barb Oakley, we've had some people on who have demonstrated that you can change the way your inner geography works, the way your brain works to an extent, how you take in data. You can change those circuits, right?
And do you really think most people have the capacity, or even more importantly, the interest to analyze what they're doing and kind of give themselves A/B testing? I think by far most people, and this is something Jonathan Haidt talks about in his book, The Righteous Mind, most people start with the assumption that what they're doing is good and that they're good people, and then they just look ex post facto for rationalizations for it.
Well, that's certainly true, but that doesn't mean that they don't have the potential to do it.
Well, I think for most people, they don't have the potential to do it because it comes at a perceptual level. They're not capable of perceiving that they're doing, they don't perceive cause and effect, or that what they're doing, you know, that makes them feel good, gives them that endorphin rush, might have negative consequences.
Right, but that may be true, but that doesn't mean that may be so. It doesn't mean that if we can prove otherwise with technique, with practice, that idea that you don't have to be a slave to your biology, right?
But some people do, is my point.
Yeah.
You're saying that there's this universal man, which is, again, a repudiation of biology. Some people have this capacity and some don't. Some people can become bodybuilders and some never will.
Yeah, that's true. There is a physical
True, but you know, I mean, that's the thing, is that part of that universal human biology is neuroplasticity and the fact that the brain is flexible. That's part of our human birthright.
Sure, but there's also the human birthright. There's also there's also a function of the size of the slate you're dealing with. And whether the quality of the chalk, you know, these are also things that matter. And no pun intended. And I think for most people, you know, they're a lost cause. What did Mencken say, that the average human being has as much effect on the world as a butterfly? I think that's absolutely certainly true. The common man has never accomplished anything by definition.
Now, you know, recognizing that you are a product of, you know, your human biology and that therefore there are things that you have that must be in common with the rest of us.
Sure.
You know, I'm really glad that you brought Jonathan Haidt up because essentially, yes, so much of his work is about the fact that we have feelings and then we look for post facto rationalizations of those feelings.
Sure.
Do you not think that it's possible that you are a pessimist and that you have a low estimation of humanity and therefore are now doing what the rest of us do, which is to cherry pick facts to justify your original feeling?
I am the most optimistic person you will ever meet. My favorite movie is Amelie. And what I disagree with you is the idea that my estimation of the world should be a function of my evaluation of human nature. Mm. The world is a lot bigger than people. People are animal species like any other. And I judge, you know, the world based on things other than my fellow man.
Hmm.
I don't exactly know what that means. Could you break that down?
You're saying that if I have a negative, and I don't know if I would say negative, but let's, for sake of argument, say I have a negative evaluation of people, therefore I have a negative evaluation, a negative worldview, a pessimistic worldview. That's not true. The term worldview means worldview. It's a function of how I view the world. It's not how I function of how I view humanity.
Right.
Humanity is just one aspect of the world. The world's a wonderful, amazing place. Life is the best thing ever, and we should try to be happy as much as we can without, you know, without doing it at other people's expense.
Yeah.
But most people don't have that capacity.
I don't think in any way, I don't think you're a pessimist or a cynic at all. In fact, the fact that you take so much time to write so passionately about subjects and talk about these things, I'm sorry. To me, it's what I really love about you. The fact that you really give a shit. I mean, you may even feel like you're shouting in the wind, but you continue
but
the fight.
That's the question.
I gotta tell you one thing. I had such an amazing response from the last show, and your listeners are so interested in ideas and in being challenged. And I got a ton of emails and a ton of tweets. I answered every single one of them. And it was very gratifying to see that there are still people out there who are interested in engaging in ideas, which there's not that much space to do in any culture because most cultures are just going to prepackage the ideas that you're allowed to subscribe to.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, and this goes back to, again, like, I think that people do have that interest. I think we're deeply unsatisfied with most of what's out there. And that if you give people the opportunity to engage with these ideas that they want to, it's a large part of it is just the fact that, you know, we are primarily emotional creatures and you have to create the right emotional context so that people feel comfortable engaging with those ideas.
I think that's what Michael does. I mean,
yeah.
I think that's what you do so well. I think that's the reason you got such a response is that when you frame ideas the way you do, and it's so obvious to tell that you really not only have thought about these things, but you really care deeply about them. People resonate with it. So it's not surprising at all that you got such a response. That's,
well, but this is not a random sample.
Mm.
And my point is, like, look, I went to Bucknell, which was a country club school. I'd never been around waspy white people before, right? And it was a shocking, epiphany of what these people are like, and it left a very bad taste in my mouth. And let me give you an example of what it was like. I was hanging out with my roommate, a buddy of mine, a former guest on your show, John Durant. We were at his house for Thanksgiving, talking to his roommate, and I said, "Let's play Would You Rather." And I said, "Would you rather be morbidly obese for the rest of your life, or be in the middle of a human centipede for a month?" And his roommate goes, "Neither. What kind of game is this? Give me some good choices." And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, it's not called Wouldn't It Be Great, right?
Right.
And I'm sitting there, I'm like, this is the problem.
Wow.
These are the kind of games you play. This is what your wife looks like. This is the music you listen to. These are the clothes you wear. Anything outside of that is weird and bad. Brian, I know you've lived all around the world. You have an interest in different cultures and interesting things, and like, let's, you know, seek it out and try it out. But Haidt talked about this also. That is a very specific psychological frame. Mm. Many people find that repugnant and horrible, and they want it as far away from them as possible. They want to be that trapdoor spider.
Yeah, man. What's his name who wrote Excellent Sheep? We had
William Dereswitz.
Yeah, he wrote a book about, he was a Yale professor, and he calls the average Ivy League student, I mean, all of them, he said it's 31 different flavors of vanilla. They're excellent sheep. They're so concerned with, and they're a little unfair. I mean, there are a lot of great people at the Ivy League, but for the most part, it was an interesting argument.
Including John Durant.
Yeah, John's great, but it was just kind of about the fact that, you know, the people are so concerned with getting to the next level and accomplishing and jumping through hoops because they want to be, you know, they want to make a lot of money and they want all these things, that they don't even bother to step outside of what they've already learned or what they already know or what's within their frame of reference because they're afraid they might fail at it. You know?
What's the point of having money if you have no values?
Right.
You know, I have money so I can buy like rare books I like, rare succulents. I can, you know, tonight I'm going to a restaurant where it's going to be a mix of Japanese and Jewish food. It's going to be amazing, right? But these people want to go to the restaurant that's been told to them by New York Magazine, you know, or watch the, you know, or buy the clothes that, you know, buy their Louis Vuitton. They have absolutely no sense of originality or creativity. And on some level, I do condemn them morally because they're lacking a fundamental aspect of being a human being, which is the aspect of choice.
Mm. But by the same token, Michael, a large part of it is that, you know, it's easy to think that there's something magical or special to people who are pushing outside of those boxes. But to a great extent, you know, you, Brian, and myself were all forced outside of that. You know, you were, you know, because of the experience of your parents living in the Soviet Union and then coming over here, you've had to think much harder about these things than the average person would growing up. Brian and I both grew up all over the world. And so, you know, we didn't naturally figure out the world easily. We had to think much, much, much harder because you're in one country and they believe one thing, and then you're in another country and they believe other things.
Sure.
And so what that does is that ultimately destabilizes whatever your, you know, national or religious or intellectual categorization is until eventually you realize that you're just are thinking in terms of being a human being.
You are absolutely crazy. Do you really think that the universal response to pressure is to grow strength and to adapt? How many people break under the spirit of pressure in a physical sense or in a mental sense? That is exactly why, you know, the three of us are talking, but this is not a random sample. There are plenty of people who were that weird Ukrainian kid in school, and they did not grow up to become, you know, interested in ideas and innovation and things like that. They became completely chastened and broken, and now they drive a desk somewhere, and they will never have anything of interest, and that's a function of, you know, them not having that capacity that we were fortunately blessed enough to be born with.
Or it might be a function, like you're saying, of their biology.
Yeah.
I see, if you had asked me that question before you went in, I would have said, yes, pressure makes a diamond. I love those expressions. I like living in that world. I like to think that, you know, all the pressure kind of creates
also
greatness.
You know,
well, historically, it probably does, though, right? Historically, I mean, let's take certain cultures. Let's take the Jews, for example. If you're, I don't think it's a mistake that the Jews are some of the most innovative, maybe the most innovative culture of all time. The originators of some of the biggest ideas that we benefit from every day. I think that had to do with the fact that if the average Jew in a lot of these countries historically realized that if they didn't make themselves useful,
sure,
my God, they were going to get kicked out of or killed or whatever it was. I mean, they were going to be blamed for the problems.
And they still might have been, in spite of being useful.
Maybe, but
sure.
But I do think that pressure and adversity and things, you know, you can, there are countless examples of this. I mean,
well, there's 6 million examples of Jews that didn't do well under pressure. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not always a function of them fleeing the country and becoming Einstein. Some of them do get crushed under the gears of society.
No question.
Yeah, and it happens at an individual level. It doesn't have to be genocide. I mean, I think this happens, and this is my, okay, this is what, where I think the heart of the problem is. If I can do one thing, the worst thing we have in this country is our public school system. Our public school system is designed explicitly to break children's spirits and to mold them into quote-unquote good citizens, which means followers who are not going to challenge authority. Those school teachers are the real villains in this country. And, you know, I was giving a talk at some leftist group, and I just said, I look at school teachers the way Chuck D looks at the cops. And I was expecting this huge backlash, and no one said anything. So I'm gratified that there's some awareness, you know, across political lines.
If well, I made you the czar.
Is that awareness, or is it just shock? Like, maybe you just shocked them into not being
as
able to
As long as
respond.
They kept their mouths shut, that's consent. That's fine with me.
Michael, what would you do about the school system if you? I made you the czar of schools? I think people,
this is not particularly insightful, people learn differently in different ways. The fact that you're graduating high school and you've never taken a logic course or you've never learned a trade, there are many people who are never going to be smart, but they are going to be, let's say, good with their hands or they're good in some other aspects. They can leave at 14, have a skill. They might not be able to do calculus, but I can't do calculus. That's okay. And there's so many tracks that you can take them in, starting at a very early age. So by the time that they're, you know, at a teenage level, they are people who have something to offer, and that is a huge plus in terms of self-esteem and self-ownership and regarding yourself as valuable because you actually are valuable.
Yeah, somebody was talking about how that we don't teach the industrial sciences. There are a lot of trades, welding and things like that, that get very, very complicated. I mean, skill trades that some people are not going to go to college, some people don't want to go to college, and
right.
And according to their geography and where they are, it may be that making those kinds of trades available and getting companies involved in it in those schools is the best thing you can do.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, some of these kids, I mean, if you're even at age five, you see they have artistic talents. They could be 14 and have, you know, enough to be a graphic design intern already and making, what, like $50 an hour?
Yeah.
Instead, they're on the track to be complete failures, regard their lives as worthless, and it's a dead end.
Hmm. I wonder if that can, as you're talking, I wonder if that can be solved with the internet. I feel like that there's all this, there's so much untapped, you know, just retirees who have a skill set that nobody is tapping into, for example. All these examples, you know.
Well, it's just like the cops and the teachers have to create this illusion that they're, you know, intrinsically valuable. And if they're taken away, society collapses. So that's a big, you know, row to hoe.
Hmm.
Well, and I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, Brian and I have talked about this before, but, you know, it's very exciting to think that technology is going to solve all of our problems for us. But fundamentally, our problems remain our problems. And, you know, a lot of the barriers that really have to be solved are not technological, but psychological.
Well, I wouldn't regard that. I mean, if I'm going to be completely pedantic, then I wouldn't regard them as barriers if it's a function of psychology, you know. If it's not superable, it's not really a barrier.
But the second big idea that you were talking about was the fact that societies are what? You mentioned heresy. And...
Yeah, so a lot of libertarians have this idea that, like, it's the government that's keeping us down. Mm. Whereas I would think literally 80% of people, if there was no disincentive legally to cheating on your taxes, wouldn't do it. I mean, they genuinely think that the government is the right thing. They genuinely are, you know, frame their conversations and how they speak based on backlash and heresy and taboo. And what that does is it outsources, instead of the state being the one dictating who's going to say and do what, it makes every citizen their own little petty dictator and enforcer of the will of the, you know, overclass.
Isn't that kind of an inevitable, you know, side effect of just creating a group that cooperates?
Yes. I think it's absolutely inevitable, but I think the big lie is that it's not inevitable, that we are going to have this kind of freak. This, you hear this from libertarians, you hear this from the left, you hear this from the right, that you're going to have this free society, and society can mean, you know, just your local community, can mean your country, where everyone just says what they want, does what they want, they're free, and they're not going to have repercussions. That will never, ever happen. That's a complete shibboleth that people need to get out of their heads, I think.
So we're always going to impose a measure of control on ourselves, regardless of who the authority is.
There's always going to be someone with the whip, you know, waiting to wield it. Usually women.
But
am I wrong?
No. Just anybody who's been married long enough knows that, you know, it may be soft power, but you will fall in line. You will fall in line.
Of course.
Yeah, there's no question.
But do you think, Michael, let me ask you this. Do you think that the whip ever has positive externalities? It's not that it's necessarily all good, but that on balance, the coercive power of the government can be a good thing.
Well, I don't know, but I wouldn't call it an externality. I think it would have positive consequences, sure. I mean, I think some people need to have to be whipped and beaten. You know, we live in a country where the greatest victims of abuse are children by their own parents. It's not husband-wife. It's not, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend. And you know, these are things you shame. If something exists as a function of biology, there almost certainly is some kind of social cause for it that has not been extirpated. And this is really a great example of how people feel shame. They don't like being isolated and treated as outcasts by their peers. And there's a reason for that. This is a mechanism that's non-coercive in the sense of, you know, you're not locking them up, for making sure people stay in line. And some people need to be told to stay in line.
Well, there's a notion of harmony. I mean, Confucius talked about that. There is a social harmony. There is, I would imagine, most of us would like to live and think that, you know, a lot of our societies, and people work very hard at this, at creating a certain amount of social harmony work.
No, I'm a troll. I want carnage. I want chaos. Whenever I'm on Facebook, I'll only like the comments especially when some crazy person's on a rage spiral, just to spew things up. But I think conflict also, you know, kind of, the truth will out through conflict. And I think conflict's encouraging because it kind of breaks down the weak and builds up the strong. So I think harmony is an illusion. I think societies are always dynamic. If you watch Pink Flamingos from 71 or 72, at the very end, Divine, who's this 300-pound drag queen, is asked for his political positions, and he says, kill everyone now, condone first-degree murder, advocate cannibalism. And at the time, everyone's clutching their pearls and being like, oh, my God, this monster. Now it's adorable, you know? And now the new taboos are things like racism and blackface and using slurs, whereas Divine is regarded as droll. So it's just a rolling issue of what's going to be the taboo of the day and things like that.
Until you have children. I mean, I think when you have children, I can speak for myself. My point of view really, it surprised me how quickly I changed.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted it to be safe.
You don't think it's biology?
Yeah, safe, clean, and sunny. I would imagine 100% it's biology. Man is in love with his own immortality. That's what he really wants. My children represent that. I don't feel that way when I look at them. I just look at these little cutie pies who are all innocent, and I just want to protect them and kiss them. But yes, I think that there is a great deal of biology at play. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there's some. I mean, you see it even, again, with pets, like they'll have a switch in their head, and all of a sudden, the person that raised them, they can't go near the puppies, you know?
Yeah.
It's absolutely something goes off in the head as well. It should. I mean, we should want people to protect their kids. I mean, that's very, very important.
Yeah. I just feel like sometimes I could make the world better if I had a psychopath detector. If I could find the people that really don't give a shit about anybody.
Oh, no. But the thing is, they give a shit about themselves, so they're going to be producers, and they're going to be empathetic because they have to know how to pass. So, you know, a psychopath is just an empathetic person you don't approve of.
Really? What do you mean by that? Because he's empathetic to himself?
No, because he has to figure out how other people are there. You know, when to loop back into what we were talking about earlier, when you co-author a person's book, a good co-author can get inside their subject's head and really kind of finish their sentences, anticipate how they speak, right? It really is this kind of mind meld in a Star Trek sense.
Yeah.
And sociopaths and psychopaths have to be able to do this on a daily basis because they live under constant fear that if someone realized who they're dealing with, holy crap, you know, the house of cards is going to fall down, to use another TV reference.
Wow.
So they're very, very good, and I studied them for a book proposal I did. They're very, very good at figuring out how other people think and mirroring and mimicking that. So they're also very, very useful because they're not subject to these emotional urges that the rest of us are.
Wow.
They see things. I mean, and there's this huge overlap. Sacha Baron Cohen's brother, I forget his name, is talking about there's this huge overlap now in psychology, thinking between autism and being a sociopath, that these two things have a lot in common.
So you're saying that sociopaths, so getting rid of all these sociopaths would not be such a good idea. You're saying that they do serve a function, that maybe there's even a genetic reason for them.
Well, it's clearly genetic. I don't know if there's a reason. I mean, the basis is genetic. They're almost certainly born that way. But the fact is, I am not someone who likes to just throw people you know, overboard, even if they're shunned socially, as sociopaths are. And again, I think someone who's like effectively a robot, you know, we're building robots now. That's the goal, is to build robots.
Yeah.
So there's certainly going to be some very clear uses for them. And right now, unfortunately, the uses for them is that they run the government.
You know, I find myself smiling every time you talk.
I am the pride of America, Brian.
I get so excited.
Brian, did you read that? One of our listeners tweeted us this article, and it was all about how, you know, the UK back in the 80s planned out this, you know, what would happen in a nuclear attack. And one of the ideas they came up with was to use sociopaths, because all of the sort of the, in inverted commas, normal people, right, would be so emotionally screwed up seeing all this death and destruction. And the sociopaths would be totally calm and could, like, just handle whatever was going on and rebuild all this, rebuild society.
That's interesting.
But this is what you're talking about with, I think this is a little bit of the confusion, because what you're describing, Hunter, are like more like full-blown autistic people, whereas real sociopaths also have issues with like impulse control and long-term thought. They're the ones who will like sleep with a woman and then not call her or take all her money and whatever. But they wind up in jail because they just don't really have this kind of long-term planning, because they don't have goals or values.
Oh, that's so interesting. Again, so they get caught. So sociopaths get found out all the time.
Yeah, but they don't get found out as sociopaths, but they get found out as transgressors. You know, they do awful things without any care or consequence, and they live for the moment because, you know, they become addicts because they're just looking for pleasure, because happiness will forever be denied to them.
Mm. Well, and that's the thing. I emailed Barb Oakley, who wrote this book, Evil Genes, which is all about sociopaths and all about her sister who was a sociopath. And she was saying, yeah, that these people think that you could ever use sociopaths to be helpful. Is, you know, doesn't really understand what a sociopath is.
Well, it could be great to sick them on someone you don't like, right?
Yeah. Well, that's true.
We should.
Maybe the U.S. Army should have a special division of sociopaths that it sends
out. They're called the fucking Congress.
so who do you really think that the majority of people that go into politics are sociopaths? Or are they just...
I don't know about sociopaths per se, that diagnosis, but there's certainly very clearly something fundamentally wrong with them, yes.
Who do you think that we would all know? Who do you think, based on your estimation after studying sociopaths, give me a couple famous sociopaths, do you think?
It actually would be very hard for them to be famous in terms of politics, because again, with the short-term impulse control, politics is a long con. So there'd be very few, but I mean, there's certainly plenty of people who I would describe as soulless who have gotten into politics. I don't think that's particularly controversial to say.
What about just famous people who are sociopaths, do you think?
Historical figures.
It's very difficult to make this kind of... First of all, I'm not a psychologist, and to judge someone based on the reports of them are...
Right.
It's very, very difficult situation to be. But if you're saying people who have aspects of sociopathy, let's put it that way, I would say certainly Hillary Clinton... who is unable to say things that are untrue, it's unable to refrain from saying things that are untrue and demonstrably untrue. Clearly something is going on there on a psychological level. It's not tactically smart for her either.
Right. It seems just ambition. I don't know.
If there are any diehard Republicans listening right now, there's a narrative that you might want to advance over the next...
Oh, no, here's the narrative for Hillary. Hillary Clinton is America's mother-in-law. And that no matter what she, her only, her, I said this on TV, Hillary, if we can make this a meme, it'll destroy her. Hillary Clinton's America's mother-in-law, her only agenda is to get on TV and wag her finger and tell you that you're doing it wrong, and even if you're doing it right, you're doing it the wrong way.
Nancy Pelosi is the same way, and by the way.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But Hillary's also another thing. She's Gollum. She had that one true ring. She wants it. She needs it. She's talking to herself like Smeagol, not making any sense. And she doesn't even know why she wants it again. And when she has it, you know, she'll find it's not as nice as she remembered it. So she's really these two things. I really desperately want her to be president.
Okay. Desperately. Now, wait a minute. So, Michael, if you were working for the Democrats, right, and let's say that you're trying to destroy Jeb Bush, if Jeb Bush is running, how would you destroy Jeb Bush?
I mean, I think Jeb Bush is just the easiest thing. It's like, do we want another 8 years of this?
Yeah.
And just, I mean, this is that would be the easiest candidate for them to put up.
Yeah. And then what about, okay, so then how would you destroy Rand Paul?
Ooh, Rand Paul. I would play up how exotic and weird his positions are, because Americans for a good 20 or 30 years have been taught we have a binary political system. Mm-hmm. The fact that he doesn't fit into this very easily makes him confusing and odd. And Hillary Clinton's a brand you can trust. So that would be very easy to kind of stigmatize him, I think.
Wow, but you like Rand Paul, don't you, overall?
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Michael, let's move on to the third big idea. What was the third big idea?
I've been running my mouth. I don't know. We're talking about, that democracy is impossible even in theory?
Yes.
Yes.
So there was this, there were these thinkers in the early, like, 1910s, Mosca, Pareda, and Engels, not Marx as Engels, and they were the founders of something called elite theory. You know, this idea that at the time populism and progressivism were kind of making their mark in the world stage, and they pointed out that, you know, no matter what your area, you're going to have a small elite who are going to be determining a policy or even determining what you're allowed to vote on. And it was Engels, I believe, who came up with what he called, it's Pareto, the circulation of the elites. Basically, you're not going to replace elites with democracy. You're just going to replace elites with one other elite. And the way I would classify this is this. Hillary Clinton has much more in common with George W. Bush than she does with, let's say, a union janitor who's voted Democrat all his life.
Now, of course.
Of course, right. But, you know, if you think, but that's not the narrative we're told culturally. Right. Culturally, Hillary and George W. Bush are archenemies. They have nothing in common. But in reality, they really are functions of the same process.
Yeah. Edmund Burke said something similar. Edmund Burke said that there is always a natural aristocracy. And by the way, it should probably stay in place to an extent, because that is sort of the natural order of things. That was an organic manifestation of how societies are structured and how they come to be.
Edmund Burke, I'm not a fan of. And this natural aristocracy has historically been used with kind of racist sexist connotations. So.
But that is kind of what the Senate is based on, right? The wise men. I mean, these are the staid older statesmen who say, wait a minute, the people are a little hot and bothered. Let's just take a minute.
Yeah, but
here,
who's really hot and bothered right now? It's the state older statesmen. I mean, it's the Senate that's the most riled up and, you know, Congress that's the most riled up. I mean, if anything, the moderate force right now in society is the people.
Well, yeah. And Michael, like Lawrence Lessig wrote a book called Republic Lost about how the only thing we should really be talking about is campaign finance reform and about what do you think of that idea that money in politics is the problem?
That's the stupidest. Oh my God! Wow. Okay, talk about bad ideas. Okay, so basically, if I take money from Microsoft, that's a problem because I'm going to be partial to Microsoft. But if I take money from the government, somehow I'm going to be impartial.
Well,
like,
no,
the government,
I mean,
magic.
Maybe if congressmen weren't so concerned with raising fund 60% of their time, and they could actually focus on common sense laws, the issues at hand.
No
such
thing as common sense law. That concept does not exist. And I would rather them be on the phone than passing bills.
Oh, that's interesting. So you kind of like the fact that they're less effective.
But the problem is they're still passing bills. It's just that those bills were written by the special interests themselves, and then they're just passing the bills without even really knowing what's in them.
Well, so, what these thinkers were saying is my point, that it's impossible to have bills that aren't going to be a function of special interest, that the elites are always going to be the ones dictating policy. And though the elites might change, it's never going to be the people, even theoretically.
But I have no idea what that means, Mike.
Meaning, what you're saying is like, okay, let's suppose.
No. Our sound engineer wrote a note.
Alec.
Oh.
Alec. A-L-E-C. You know about Alec?
No.
Alec Baldwin.
Let's finish this thought.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, but my point is that even theoretically, you know, let's suppose you have public finance and public campaigns. Those politicians are still going to be beholden to the powerful people in the culture, even if they're not just getting checks from them directly.
But, to go back to point number two, right, we are products of our human biology, right?
Right.
And so
that was the first point.
I'm sorry.
The Malik manifesto has got to be adhered to exactly.
Yeah.
Or I will take a fucking whip to your backside.
I'm sorry. I was still thinking about succulents.
Master Malik, I'm sorry about that. I'll rub succulents all over your body.
Oh, that would actually
until
be quite
you're
nice.
All shiny.
Aloe. Well, aloe is a succulent.
Yeah, exactly. That would be nice.
I use it
like
as a deodorant.
That.
It works really well. Keep going.
But anyway, so, you know, to go back to that point, whatever point it was, you know, I didn't realize how important the order was.
It's the first point on the tablet!
But you know, you're saying that that we have human biology, and so therefore, for example, right, you know, if you compare, I don't think you would say, for example, that communism and capitalism are indistinguishable, right? Capitalism,
of course not.
Right, so capitalism is a better system because it recognizes human impulses, the desire to pursue our self-interest, allows us to do that and realizes that the consequences of that are much, much better. So presumably laws that are designed in accordance with our human biology rather than, for example, communism, a system which repudiates human biology, is better. Like, shouldn't we – there are good laws. Laws can be designed based – no?
I don't agree, because laws have to be implemented by human beings. So when let's look at the Constitution, which is a supposedly magical spell that all these brilliant founding fathers put into being and now has guaranteed prosperity for all mankind forever – you have the judges who still have to read these laws and pretend that when it says no speech, there's a distinction between obscenity or political speech. People in the legal profession, and the legal profession will always be dominating politics, they will find every which way to eviscerate anything that's written down. Laws do not have the power to enforce themselves. So there's no such thing as a good law.
Well, but, you know, the founding fathers recognized that. I mean, you know, James Madison was very clear in the Federalist paper that if men were angels, we wouldn't need governments, right? But they're not. And so, but nonetheless, right, there are systems that are maybe not perfect, but certainly better than other systems,
right? Yeah, I mean, I want some police force to protect me against a group of thugs that organize and get big guns and come in and take over my town.
And I would much rather live in...
But the government is that group of thugs, don't you understand?
Yeah, but they are that group of thugs, but the point is that group of thugs serves a purpose. I mean, you know, Steven Pinker, right, who we've been talking about, wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, and in early, early society, right, the level of violent death was much, much, much higher. And now, you know, the point is that, yes, the government has a monopoly on violence, but it's much better that the government have a monopoly on violence.
It's also not organized. It's also a lot less organized than a biker gang.
That's right.
I am not going to argue that bad things can have positive consequences. I'm not a consequentialist. I think bad things have positive consequences all the time.
Okay.
That's not an ex post facto validation or justification for them.
It also doesn't mean that you're not an anarchist.
I absolutely don't try me. I absolutely am an anarchist, but the point is, you're also making the fallacy that if it wasn't this, then the alternative would necessarily be worse.
No, I'm not making that fallacy at all. All I'm saying is that I'm not saying that the alternatives are either the United States or North Korea. I'm just saying that if you compare the United States and North Korea, you know, the first thing is to recognize that there are systems that are better laws or better systems than other systems.
Yes.
And so if that's possible, then it must be that presumably if we understand our human biology better and better and better, that we can go for even better laws than the ones that currently exist. And I'm not saying that it'll be perfect, but presumably, you know, as we like to say here in L.A., progress, not perfection.
I agree with progress, not perfection. However, I don't think what you're seeing as progress in the States is a function of quote-unquote better laws. I think it's a function of better technology and people being able to hinder the power of the state. And I think it's a function of more positive and factual ideas being spread in the culture.
I agree with that. I would not disagree with that one bit. I think that's a really, really important point.
I would say so, but I think that the other thing that you have to bear in mind is that, you know, technologies are, you know, value neutral. And the point is, I mean, to some extent, I mean, yes, it's not entirely value neutral. Like the printing press absolutely, you know, overall improves things. The internet overall improves things. But you also have to remember that part of the reason why campaign finance has gone so nuts is because of improvements in television, improvements in mass mailings, improvements in all of those sorts of things. So at the same time that ideas are disseminating themselves better, it's also a large part of the reason why the government has become so obsessed with raising money.
I don't have any problem with that fact, with the fact that all this money is being put into politics. I think it's great. So I would disagree with you there, and I would say technology is value neutral. It's not value neutral, but I think the important thing to bear in mind is all the advances in freedom in the last, you know, let's say 50 years have been a function of technology. If we can make it a way where the government doesn't know how much you have in your bank account, they can't access it, that will eliminate government oppression overnight. Right now, censorship used to be the norm. The king or whatever, you have to put your book to the censor, and then if the censor says no, the book's not going to be published. Now a book can't be censored at all. Even if they wanted to censor a book, it's on torrent immediately, and it's going to be maintained on the internet in perpetuity. So these are all the talking and all the spreading don't matter as long as you have the power to put these ideas into practice.
Maybe Michael's just a...
You can't spend yourself rich and you can't vote yourself free.
And you know, there's also some evidence that when a candidate does spend a fortune on his campaign, voters will sometimes turn on you. Voters sometimes go, you know what? That guy's an elitist. I'm not going to vote for him. That could be a liability, too.
And political spending is value neutral in the sense that, yeah, you're paying TV shows and you're paying people to make those commercials and so on and so forth, you know, to persuade. But the alternative is you're just going to tax everyone. I'd rather have only rich people, you know, funneling into these politicians than my money being going to support two people I don't like.
Oh, that's, yeah. Well,
they're going to have that backdoor anyway, I think, is my biggest point with the elite theory.
Yeah.
Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg will always be able to get any senator on the phone, regardless of whatever the system's campaign contributions is.
That's true.
That's what elite theory means.
And it's never been any different. I mean, it's never been.
And it can't be any different is the point of this whole philosophy. It's like that's the only way any society works.
Right.
Yeah, but by the same token, yes, the elites will always have special access, but it's the degree of access that they have. For example, the level of access that the elites have and the level of power that the elites have in some place like North Korea or even in the British monarchy before the Glorious Revolution, as compared to the people, is far greater than the level of access that, you know, the people have in certain other situations, whether it's Greek democracy of, you know, the Athenian period or whether it's, you know, modern American democracy. There are degrees of inclusivity. I mean, the whole point of why nations fail is that there are different societies have different levels of political and economic inclusivity. So, yes, the elites will probably always have more access. In fact, they almost certainly will. But that doesn't mean that the people can't be more included in some places and that we shouldn't strive for that.
In terms of the fact that there should be always potential in a society for you to become one of the elites. That's also very important.
Because that's nonsense also, because most people do not have that within them. But my point is, if the ability of the elites to enforce their will on, you know, the average person were stunted, that's the goal. Because it's inevitable that they're going to be there, is my point. But how do you put handcuffs on them?
Well, the way you put it, you don't put handcuffs on them. What you do is you create a circumstance where there is an incentive structure for the everyday man to come up with an idea, build a company around it, make a lot of money, and become one of the elites himself.
But
that's kind of what happens.
Now he's prey for the bloodsuckers.
Oh, true. You're speaking of that now he gets taxed 50% of his income. Yes.
I mean, not only taxed, but he can't act according to his conscience because, you know, you have all these whips around him.
Mm. Well, but I mean, first of all, I think that the one thing that I think we have to nurture is the marketplace. Here's why. The marketplace is a good barometer because when you become very wealthy because you create a product, let's say the iPad or whatever it is. But you better stay current with people's tastes and with the inexorable march and maybe even exponential march of technology, or another company is going to come along. It might be a kid in college comes up with a better idea. Now he's worth $1 billion because he sells it to Google or whatever. So I think that the idea is to make sure that there is a constant ability for, you know, you as an individual to profit from your ingenuity and your risk-taking and all that other stuff. And I think big banks, big corporations should have to compete in the marketplace as well. When they have power to influence government to the extent that they seem to have, and it's growing, that's where the problems lie.
No, my point is they will always have the power to influence government. The question is, will the government have the power to influence economics? It's the same reason as you – look, the idea was if you separate church and state, then religion's going to go away and everyone's going to become a murderer. That didn't happen. Mm. And if you separate government and economics, it's going to be the same thing. You're going to have a greater diversity. Everyone can shop wherever whatever they want. In the old days, the church had the army to go out and kill people that they didn't like, you know, the Crusades and the Inquisition and things like that. And nowadays, you have this with the same thing with corporations, where they can hire the government to put people out of business under dubious
pretenses. That's right. That's right. So get the government out of the marketplace.
Right. So Michael, let's again, like you're the czar of the world or the emperor of the world.
Just because
right?
I'm Russian, I got to be a czar.
Yes. Yes. You bastard. Yes.
All right. No pogroms. I'm going to be new and improved.
Okay. Good.
No pogroms.
Just like Putin.
I'm a modern day Putin.
So
as long as you don't pose with your shirt off on a horse.
Wait a minute.
Actually, I want you to.
Michael,
I've been doing a lot of bench work. You don't know what's under this shirt.
Good man.
But wait a minute, Michael, I'm guessing that you've seen this. Did you ever see that pop song, Takova Kak Putin?
No. Oh, I heard of it. I haven't seen it, no.
Oh, it's amazing. It's this pop song from like 2001 or something like that. And it's these two incredibly attractive young Russian pop stars singing about how they want a man like Putin. That's like the ultimate dream. It's like, really, it's pretty amazing.
Awesome.
But anyway, and it is on YouTube, and it is subtitled. So just so that the listeners
believe
know.
Believe me, I almost reached for my phone, but we're in the middle of an interview.
But anyway, what I was going to say is, so let's say that we absolutely separate, you know, the marketplace and the government, right? Then what is the government doing? Presumably the government still has to tax in order to be able to preserve.
No.
Okay, lay it out for us.
The government in any society is basically a secularized version of religion, where people go and they vote, which is the equivalent of taking communion, they're told what are the big problems. Politicians are good at one real thing. They are very good at finding out problems and making these problems into a big deal. So if the government were voluntary, that would be a great mechanism to direct, you know, kind of what we call not-for-profit activity and help people point to the help where it needs to be helped. Mm. And the people who want to help certain issues can, and the people who don't, that's fine too. And just like, you know, that was the function of the church back in the day. So it's really a continuation of the same idea.
Wow. I love the way you categorize
that.
I'll steal that. I can't wait for my next cocktail party.
But what about, okay, so then what about, you know, the functions of the police? Like,
You mean shooting dogs and throwing grenades into babies' cribs?
Michael, stop being such a firebrand.
Here's something. I'll tell you a funny story. I did an interview with the BBC like 8 years ago, and you know, I'm obnoxious sometimes, but I was on my best behavior, and we're talking about a book I was doing, and they go, you know, Michael, in this book, you make fun of cops a lot. Is that something you've gotten heat for? And I said, and I swear on my life, I thought I was being innocuous. I said, well, because I was talking to British people, you know what I mean? I thought they'd be, you know, pretentious, obnoxious. I said, well, it's like my dad told me, which is true, no matter what country you go to, no matter where you find yourself in the world, the stupidest people are always the cops. And the guy audibly gasped, and he said, this is a family show. And he immediately changed the subject.
Oh, boy.
I was very taken aback. And it's only in America that people have this idea that the cops aren't just evil, violent thugs who need to be restrained at all costs and at all times.
Yeah, but we need... I mean, I know a lot of cops that I actually like and who are good men.
I'm sure
men.
They're great people. I'm not arguing with that whatsoever, and I'm sure they would have great...
Where would
and
we
I'll tell
be,
you what to
but,
do.
Wait, wait, when a kid is abducted, et cetera, et cetera, I want good detectives who want to make the world a better place. And
right,
there are
that's
a lot
why
of
you don't want cops.
There.
You want good detectives, exactly.
But you
so
need
my
cops.
Point is this.
Yeah.
Any place you go in our country, the safest places are those where the establishment has to take care of its own security. If you go to a hotel anywhere in the world, you are surrounded by strangers by definition who are from different countries who you'll never encounter. It is far safer than walking the streets. Wherever the government is in charge of security, the streets, the subways, things like that, that is where it's most dangerous. But if you go to a bar, every bar has a bouncer. Huh. If you go to a movie theater, if you go to the store.
So when there is a monetary interest in the establishment of the society to keep people safe, they are going to be much better at providing that security than any central authority.
Every government, every society has a monetary interest in keeping people safe. I mean, that's the most basic monetary interest. But the government has an interest in keeping people afraid and keeping people under submission. And that's exactly what the cops do.
But I don't
you
know. I don't know that that's. By- I don't think, Michael, well, but- that that's a top down, you know, deliberate. machination in the minds of those in power.
It could just work at an evolutionary level. It doesn't have to be top-down and conceived consciously. It could just be this is what wins out because this is what solidifies power in the state when you're killing people you don't like and having everyone in a state of fear to speak against you. That's how North Korea works.
Right. So if we've got obviously there are places like bars and, you know, private venues that have their own secure hotels, they have their own private security. What would you advocate for those public spaces, places like subways?
Abolish them.
You would just abolish
all public space. Absolutely. And that way it'll be safe for everyone. Whoever owns the road will make sure there's no car accidents. They will have a huge incentive to say our roads are safe. Look at car companies, right? Our cars are safer than your cars, right? It would be the same thing with roads. It'll be the same thing with neighborhoods. Come to our neighborhood. We don't have crime. You go to that neighborhood, you're going to have a lot of crime. This is a very easy selling point, especially for parents, because parents want to go to those roads where the kids aren't going to get hit and when their dogs aren't getting shot by fat losers.
Well, you know, you are speaking like a true libertarian.
I don't like that word, okay.
Yeah, but you are. I mean, you're saying that people can govern themselves.
No, people can hire people to keep the bad people at bay.
Yeah.
So, but wait a minute, Michael. Okay,
because
then,
there's an incentive.
If you don't like the word libertarian, what word do you like? How would you
anarchist?
Anarchist. Yeah.
Anarchist. Michael Malice, the anarchist. I hope you don't get a speeding ticket. But I hope no cops are listening to this. Because man, if I was a cop, I'd be like, well. If it ain't
exactly.
Malice.
That's exactly my point. That
no.
is exactly my point,
that
and that is exactly how they think,
point.
And that's why that it draws the most disgusting people in our culture.
I don't think so. My experience, I mean, look, you know, I don't think that the majority of people that go into the police are those kind of people.
They're not in a position to open their mouths. They are not in a position to open their mouths against their buddies. And that happens in any group. In any company, the disincentive to being a whistleblower is enormous and profound.
But isn't that also going to be true if you're dealing with private security as well?
It's going to be a lot less true because there's going to be the eye of the market on them. Like, look at eBay. You have feedback ratings, right?
Right.
If you have a cop company where children have grenades being thrown in their cribs. I saw this video. I'm sorry to sound like some kind of PETA freak and these shock stories. I saw this video of a Florida deputy, wherever she was. It was, you know, like kind of the camera in the corner of the room. There was a guy in a wheelchair she's wheeling in. She thought he was faking. She knocked him out of the wheelchair to prove he can walk. When she saw that he couldn't really walk, he really was in a wheelchair, she pushed him back in the wheelchair. But there was no, like, oh, my God, what have I done? I'm a horrible people. It's like, well, oops, I guess I was wrong. That is what I'm against. And I think those types of people are universally empowered when they become police. Because they have no consequences to acting in these absolutely inhuman ways.
So some people are drawn to a position of authority where they can have a badge and carry a gun, etc.
Look, the reason I like being on TV is because I like being obnoxious and offensive, and there's no disincentive. It's rewarded. If I talk this way at parties, people roll their eyes and go away from me.
Not me.
Not you.
Yeah.
But trust me, especially in certain rooms I've been in, especially at Bucknell, you know, where everyone's like, you know, Durant's roommate, why would you want to play this game?
Yeah.
People, you know, so it's the same thing. Like, if I am someone who gets off on throwing my weight around, I'm going to be drawn to being a cop. I mean, that makes perfect sense. It's not
well,
you know, that weird.
I think I take your point as less an attack at cops and more the idea I'm taking away from it is that the idea is, if we got rid of all the police, it'd be anarchy. People would be killing each other. And you're saying quite the opposite. In fact, it'd
Correct.
Be safer because there would be, you know, people would own whether it's the subway station or a road, and they'd say, my road is safer. Come to my road. It'll cost you a little something, but if you want to pay, you know, you're going to be safe. This neighborhood.
It costs you something now anyway. But
yes.
Those cops that you're friends with, who I'm sure really are great people, they don't have an opportunity to be cops in the sense I'm describing because the government forces a monopoly.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not as – I understand what you're – I like your general point. I think your point is that is well taken, and it is a libertarian point of view, maybe an anarchistic point of view. But there is a very strong argument. I mean, we had – who was it we had on who talked about when you take traffic signals out of certain
–
Matthew May wrote a book about the law of subtraction. When you take traffic signals out of certain major intersections that are very busy, Hans Mondermann, who is the guy who kind of did this – guess what? The people figure their way through. There are no accidents because they're focusing on what's in front of them, not the traffic signal. So, you know, there is a lot of evidence to suggest, and I would lean on to your point of view that human beings can figure it out.
No, but it's not only that. It's that just look at the evidence. Where are you safest? Hmm. You are always safest where it's under private jurisdiction, even in a space where everyone is drunk and on drugs.
Yeah, I've never thought of that, Michael, but I have to say you are 100% right. This is, again, why I smile when Michael Malice talks. I mean, you do change minds, man. I mean, your arguments are fantastic.
And bring families together.
You bring families together.
Just like our fearless leader, Kim Il-sung.
Yes.
Great leader, yes.
God help you. Michael Malice, what else can I say?
By the way, I do want to thank you, Michael, on your recommendation. After finishing your book, I listened to Nothing to Envy.
God, isn't that great?
It's a really well-done book.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, so good. Yeah. It'll haunt you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, Michael Malice wants a better world for everyone, ladies and gentlemen.
No, that's right. Not everyone, but okay.
not
Michael,
everyone.
One question that I did ask Brian at the beginning, and I really should have asked you, is Malice your last name by birth, or did you choose that name?
It's chosen.
Yeah,
that's what I figured.
Michael Malice, baby. You don't have to tell us your real name. I like Malice.
It is my real name. It's just not my birth name.
There you go.
There you go.
You have a right to choose your own name. Somebody gave.
Of course,
Michael Malice is like, somebody gave me this name. No thanks.
No.
I'm coming up with my
own
name.
It's a good litmus test for people sometimes if they take it with a straight face. And if they ask what my birth name is, I tell them Kevin Malice.
What would you do if you couldn't be a writer?
I don't like being a writer particularly.
Really?
I'm only a writer because A, I don't want to go into an office, and B, I don't ever want to talk to someone I don't want to. I'm a big introvert. So if I could, I mean, I would love to, you know, I like broadcasting and but writing is fun. Just being an idea person, as long as it pays the rent and I can buy a succulent here and there. My needs are not that
as long
big.
As I can tend to my succulent garden, I'm fine. I'm a simple man.
So, Michael, now that you have all the succulents, are you gonna? Is there somewhere else that your attention is going? Something else you're gonna start collecting?
You know what? You're hurting me because what I did is I went down this denim hole because there's this whole denim subculture. And I got this last pair of like Japanese mud dyed denim, you know, from Japan, the last pair in the world. And I wore it to all the cool cool denim boutiques in LA, and no one praised me. So I was like,
damn it.
Like, come on. These are like the last pair, and they're mud dyed. The Japanese stick it in volcanic mud for 6 months. So my denim kick has now come to a close.
This is what I love about you. You're literally talking about these huge ideas, and then you're like, and I wore denim, and nobody noticed. And they were very special denim. They were these mud dyed. Japanese denim, it is great. It is great. You go from the most superficial value system to the deepest thoughts. I love me some Michael Malice.
And this is why I'm not a pessimist, because life, you know, is good in all cylinders.
If you're going to be in Tempe this weekend, which you won't be, I'll be doing stand-up at the Tempe Improv, everybody, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And if not, just listen to this podcast over and over again. Michael Malice and his amazing ideas. God, sorry for any police officers. I'm friends with plenty of them. And I just want you to know, I love you guys and thank you. And you make me feel safe. Don't listen to the Russian firebrand over here. He's probably a plant.
My best friends are cops.
There you go. Famous last lines. You're probably a plant. Kim Jong-il sent this guy over after he brainwashed him, everybody.
The Manchurian candidate, yes.
Exactly,
by the way, I'm currently looking at a picture of two Japanese people, you know, dyeing these denim pants with the greatest care in this mud. I mean, like, of course the Japanese people have, like, two people on a single pair of pants, like that level of attention to
detail.
How
much do they cost, Michael? How much do these jeans cost? I'm curious.
Quickly, the acme of Japanese denim were something called kakishibu, which was an ancient Japanese dyeing technique where they dye the fabric in unripened persimmon tannins, right? And they applied those to denim for the first time, and someone was making a pair of samurai, made a pair for $500, but I found a pair for $140. These mud dye were $200, which is the most I felt comfortable spending.
I own a pair of $200 pants.
That's not that crazy. Yeah, and like it was something like, well, the dilemma was my mom said, I'll buy you a pair of pants however much you want. I go, okay, what's the point of inflection where if you spend a lot, do you want to wear them all the time to get your money's worth, or do you want to never wear them so not damage them, right? So
right.
It becomes this insane, autistic calculation of utility. So I thought 200 was a sweet spot where you're not going to feel bad.
All I got from that story was that your mom buys you jeans. I
well,
love it.
It was my birthday.
Oh, it was your birthday. Sorry, Bubba. Sorry, it's
yeah,
your birthday.
Yeah, she didn't buy me presents, so she felt bad. So she's like, buy whatever jeans you want.
Can't wait to hang with you in New York, my friend.
Love it.
Great to talk to you. Thank you for doing the Brian Callen on Demott Show, ladies and gentlemen. And what are we going to call this show?
Well,
we're going to call this podcast the mother of all podcasts.
Well, do you like that? Because, I mean, that's the real thing. It's not what we
all
think,
all that matters
Brian.
Is does Michael,
Michael Malice
like it?
It?
Yeah.
Do you like
it? Wait, call it GOAT.
GOAT?
Why GOAT?
Greatest of all time, G-O-A-T.
Oh, I like that. Greatest
that's
of all time.
That's an internet acronym, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And listen, Brian, you do look kind of like a goat.
Yeah, well.
And I do have cloven hooves because of my Jewish heritage.
I was going to say, he's got to shave his horns down all the time. Ah, these Jews. I'm horny as a goat, I'll tell you that much, ladies and gentlemen. And suddenly my voice, what is this? I'm a creep. Michael, when I see you, I want you to wear that denim and we'll do some swinging, if you know what I mean. All right. A couple of straight guys with big brains.
And mud-dyed Japanese
denim. Check
this out,
ladies and gentlemen. That's right.
I'm losing it.
You're awesome. All right, go tend to your succulent garden.
They're dormant. They're dormant. It's winter. I'm fine.
All right. Gee whiz, man. Ah. What an anarchist. God damn it. God damn it. Censor him! Gag him! All right. Michael Malice, you're the best. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.